Hello, listeners. Hi, I'm Dr. Margaret Vaughn, and welcome to Getting Smarter, a podcast where I get to talk with some of the most transformational thinkers and leaders in the field of education, all in the hopes of getting smarter. Join me in listening and learning.
Well, welcome. Today we have Dr. James V. Hoffman visiting us today, and I'm so excited. And welcome, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
I am great, and I am excited to be part of this, particularly since I recognize that my longtime mentor, Jerry Duffy, was the first of your
Oh,
first of your participants. So it's really a
I love it. I love it. And you are just a huge fan of mine. So I'm going to go ahead and read your biography because it's just amazing. So I'm going to get us started and read it. So Dr. Hoffman served as a member of the Reading Literacy faculty at the University of Texas at Austin for 43 years, with an additional 4 years at the University of North Texas. He is a former editor of the Reading Research Quarterly and the yearbook of the National Reading Conference. He has served as the president of the National Reading Conference and as a member of the board of directors of the International Reading Association. Dr. Hoffman was an affiliated scholar with both the National Reading Research Center and the Center for the Improvement of Early Reading Achievement. He was elected to the Reading Hall of Fame in 2002 and served as the president of this organization from 2008 to 2010. Dr. Hoffman also served as the chair for the International Reading Association's Commission and the Prepared to Make a Difference Research Project. He has been an active member. He has been so active in international literacy projects in Central America, Africa, and Asia. The primary focus for his research has been on teaching and teacher preparation. In 2018, he received the Literacy Research Association's Oscar Causey Award for outstanding contributions to reading research. Dr. Hoffman has published over 150 articles, books, and chapters on literacy-related topics, and he served as a first and fifth grade teacher in Milwaukee Public Schools and as a reading specialist with Overseas Dependent School System in Zweibrücken,
Zweibrücken.
Germany. I practice that. He is currently professor emeritus at the University of Texas at Austin and one of my favorite scholars and people of all time, and I can't stop smiling. So welcome. I'm so happy that you're here.
It's so good to see you, Margaret. I'm excited to be here. I thank you for sharing the questions. I have not prepared answers to the questions, so I'm, as you said, I hope it turns more into a conversation and things that I say that might be of interest. I would invite you to turn that into a discussion conversation. So,
Oh, I
good.
just love it. Well, you really are like just a kind of a quick connection. The first time I met you was on in Jerry's class, Jerry Duffy's class. And it was before I even had gone to LRA because I was a classroom teacher, and you had guest Skyped at the time, was like all the rage. And Jerry had Skyped you in, which was kind of an amazing thing too, because Jerry, he used the technology to Skype you in, and that was really fun. And I just remember just the rapport you and he had, and just the insight. And I was just an immediate fan. And I think it was just pretty early on in the program. And so I don't know, back, yeah, I'm just, it's like I always, I have to stop smiling. I know my cheeks are gonna hurt, but I'm just so happy that you're here, and it's just so delightful. So I wondered, before we get started, so why did you go into the field of education? What, why teaching?
I never ever thought of myself as becoming a teacher. That was never, there are no teachers in my family. There are no, I mean, it is, it was just not, I mean, I hear all of the stories that people tell about their path into teaching, and it's usually a family member or a mentor or their mother or dad or something that they'd want to do since they were in second grade or something. I had absolutely no thought or desire to go into teaching. I was an economics major in college, small Benedictine College, and it's an economics major. And I was there from 1962 through 1960, 66. And during that time period, there was a lot going on. Obviously, Vietnam War was quite present, particularly toward the latter part of that period. And also Kennedy and the Peace Corps. So when I heard about the Peace Corps and thought about, well, that's something I could do, I decided that I wanted to do. So I applied for and ended up as a Peace Corps volunteer in Peru and Ecuador for 2.5 years. And that was an amazing experience and one that I think has shaped my work. It wasn't in education. I wasn't in teaching. I was more in community development, working in rural areas. So it wasn't that the direct experience in the Peace Corps affected my decision to go into teaching, but I think it affected my perspective on a lot of things. And I carry those forward in terms of almost all of the work that I've done. Toward the end of Peace Corps, not sure again what I was going to do in my life, I heard about the Teacher Corps, and I had never heard of Teacher Corps, didn't know what Teacher Corps was, but it sounded to me like this pathway from being a Peace Corps volunteer into working in urban areas and particularly in Latino communities. And so I signed up and became a member of Teacher Corps. And that Teacher Corps experience was in Milwaukee. And it was about 2 years. It was the old Teacher Corps. It was a way of initially trying to attract people who had degrees in things other than education into working in urban schools and in low-income communities. And so I signed up, and that's what I did in Milwaukee. It was Milwaukee has quite a large Latino community, and that's where my school was. And the Teacher Corps experience is something that, again, affected the ways in which I view teacher education, because it was pioneering in the way of one third of the time was spent in your academic coursework with UWM. One third of your time was spent in classrooms in your school, and one third of your time was spent working in the community. And you had to live within 8 blocks of the school that you were working in. It was a very, very tight cohort of people who came to teaching through that path. And it was a remarkable sort of, I think in many ways, I have tried to replicate that experience in my work in terms of all the features that were part of that initial Teacher Corps experience. And it's very, I mean, in many ways, we'll probably talk about this. It was an experience like what people are doing today with internships and with residency programs, but I still think there are some really important differences between what Teacher Corps was and what residency programs are today. So once I got into an elementary classroom, once I got into first grade.
Yeah, what was that like?
I was captured. I knew that that's what I wanted to do, and that was going to be my life. I did not anticipate at that point ever thinking about higher ed. I just wanted to be a first grade teacher. And I loved every minute of it. And Milwaukee was very innovative. I think historically, looking back on what was happening in Milwaukee public schools, with language experience and non-graded primaries and all of the things that were part of the school system at that time were incredibly innovative and longstanding. And so I stayed there, worked in first grade, moved up to fifth grade for a couple of years, and then went overseas and decided to try out my master's degree in reading as a reading specialist. And then after that came the opportunity to go to my doctoral program.
Well, I knew, so I'm a former first grade teacher, so I wonder if that's the in awe of you that I have. It's fascinating too that you decided to go overseas. Was that like based, you feel like, on the experience with the Peace Corps? Did you just have like this energy to get out there and go back out?
I think it was. I don't think I'd ever even been to Europe at that point. And so it was an opportunity. I mean, it was motivated by an interest in working internationally, which I've always, that's, if you just trace my career, my international work has been constant and consistent because I value that. I always value that notion of stepping out and then looking back in, and coming back different. And so it always takes me in that direction that I become more critical. And more circumspect, I guess, about the way things are and the way things could be. So And it was the opportunity to be a reading specialist also. That was something I was getting more and more interested in. And so it was being a reading specialist in the department, in the Dodd School system, was something that it was an opportunity that we just took up. And again, it was a very, very innovative approach to using reading specialists in schools. It was not at all working with individual kids, although that, again, it was kind of divided in a third of the time you were supposed to be working with kids, but mostly you're working in classrooms, working with teachers, working with school program, school reading program. The innovative way of thinking about what reading specialists do that I experienced there, I brought back as part of my sort of wish to continue to work in graduate programs, working with those who are moving toward reading specialist sort of positions.
That's so fascinating, Jim. So tell me a little bit about, you've just been involved in so many amazing everything, right? Board of directors work, your leadership work. So I wondered a little bit about that part of it in terms of like being involved in Sierra and, you know, how did those come about? I mean, I know that how did that work happen for you kind of as you were starting off?
You know, maybe you rephrase that question. I didn't thought about it quite that way. Let me back up just a little bit.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I went to UMKC, which is a very, University of Missouri, Kansas, a very small doctoral program. But it had an amazing reading faculty. And I, at that time, got hooked up with two faculty members. One was David Allen. You might not know David Allen. Dave was in the language arts area of the program at UMKC, and he was a good student. He was one of the miscuteers, the original miscuteers.
Yeah.
So he brought with him all of these perspectives on language and literacy that were, for me at that time, were remarkably different from the ways in which I had thought about reading. He was my major professor, but sadly he was killed in an accident and right in the transition of my main program moving into my dissertation.
That's horrible.
Cutting his hedges with clippers, clipped a wire and was electrocuted. So,
oh God, that's horrible.
Very sad. And sometimes I wonder about my career path, if he had continued to be part of it, but he is always a part of me and what I do because of his philosophy. I took a seminar class with him, and he had this top shelf in his office, and he said, "These are my top shelf books. These are the books that brought me to where I am." And he said, "I want you to read all those books, and every week we'll come together and we'll talk." And that was, it's still the most amazing seminar class I've ever participated in. There was one other doctoral student that was with me that took my class. So that's where my introduction to Vygotsky, my introduction to everything came through that experience. But in the meantime, as a graduate student trying to earn a living, I worked with Ron Carver. So Ron had just come to UMKC, came from AIR, was an amazing person, an amazing friend, and the exact opposite of Dave Allen in terms of how he thought about reading. So I'm not sure if people who listen to this will recognize Ron Carver, but Ron was the spearhead of SSSR. He organized, he created that. He was a very adamant psychologist, educational psychologist and researcher, very focused on post-positivist kind of research methods, statistics, and so on. And so what my preparation was from his side was a way of understanding research that I don't think I would have gotten with anyone else, both the research methods, designs, statistics, thinking in those quantitative sort of realms, mm-hmm. And with those tools. Ron was enormously influential. In fact, my first publication in RRQ was a publication with Ron Carver, looking at a version of repeated readings using a system that he had developed. So those I came out with this very sort of divided sort of worldview between Dave Allen and those people who are more focused on child-centered pedagogies. And the Ron Carvers of the world. So I was a little schizoid. I was anticipated going to a small school, something like the one I graduated with, and sort of living out my career, doing the work of a teacher educator, but at a small non-research institution. That changed when I was when I graduated and applied to some schools, and I was hired at the University of Texas. And so that immediately raised the bar in terms of what I was going to do and who I was going to be, yeah, and where I was going to work. And that relationship, so I'm actually getting to your question. The relationship that I had at the University of Texas with the faculty there, Connie Jewell, Nancy Roser, just go down the line, just amazing, amazing people. Sort of up the ante and up the game in terms of what I was going to be doing, and how engaged I was going to be in sort of scholarly communities like LRA, like IRA. That sort of led me along that path. And from there, I think it always works through connections. The other big part of the University of Texas was at that time, the University of Texas R&D Center for Teacher Education. It was there at UT Austin. And this actually gets into my relationship with Jerry. Because I was working with the R&D, because I reached out into that R&D community and started working part-time with the R&D Center, my work in teacher ed and it began to connect me up with the other R&D centers around the country, and people were doing that kind of work. So Jerry's work at Michigan with what was his center called? It wasn't the Center for Research on Teaching. It was the Center for Research on Teaching. But Jerry, within that community of people who were studying teaching, was Jerry, who was also studying teaching, but also very interested in teacher education and teacher development. And plus you had the innovative program going on at Michigan State. That was something that I locked into right away because this is what I want to do at Texas. And so that relationship, I guess from that relationship with Jerry and from other networks that I was establishing, it gave me opportunities to engage and connect with particular kinds of work. I had started with LRA, with Ron Carver in 19, God, it was the first LRA conference was in Kansas City. It had never been in Kansas City before. And it's the only time it was in Kansas City. And that must have been 1972 or 73.
Wow.
Or maybe 74. But anyway, I haven't missed an LRA since then, or NRC since that time. And you can't get involved in those professional communities without building relationships and friends. So I was just fortunate at every turn with the people that I worked with to get engaged with and connected. And that's what happened with the centers that I was involved with, both after Center for Study of Reading sort of reconstituted and moved. I became involved with them through Georgia and then through Michigan, but almost always through connections. Like everyone else, I ended up with a very good relationship with David Pearson, and when you're with David, things are always happening. Those people were very important to me as mentors in my career, and what I was able to do. Now, none of them were specific to the kind of work that I was doing. Well, Jerry was, to the kind of research that I was doing. So the different projects and different focus points were influenced by ideas within the profession, other people within the profession that I was beginning to connect to.
Wow.
I haven't gotten to any of your questions.
Oh, no. You have totally. I think that the pathway, and I love the way that you connected earlier scholars for you, earlier teachers that you had that were such huge mentors. I find that to be such a wonderful tribute, and also just how they've, you know, these people leave imprints that stay with you after all the years. And I love that you make those connections to those early times when you were a student, and how that really influenced you in your work. I find that fascinating, that doing this through this process, that there are teachers that influence us that continue to help propel us forward. It's just kind of that recursive circle that happens in the work. Absolutely. That I think it's beautiful.
And to build on that a little bit is, I don't want to leave out the influence that my students and the students I've worked with and my colleagues, but also the students that I've worked with over the years have had on the work that I did. I mean, it's their enthusiasm, their insight, their sort of critical friend stance sometimes was enormously influential. I've just gone through and been able to work with amazing, amazing doctoral students. Almost all of them who working with me, not just on research, but also in the teacher education program that we set up at UT Austin. So all of them, I'm trying to think, there were quite a few former first grade teachers. But all of them have really done a lot to shape studies, to shape work, to shape the pathways that I've been involved with.
Oh, I just love it. I mean, there's so many we can talk about. So you mentioned a lot about your international experiences too. So, you know, what about those that really stuck with you? I mean, in terms of, I know that you talked about ways of doing kind of the reading specialist work. Was there anything that you can think about that really was similar across the different sites you were at, or different? Like, I wondered about some of the different contexts and how that influenced you in your thinking.
I think, so the real spur to my international work came as a board member of IRA. So I had been lucky at some point along the way to have been invited to run for as a board member. And I won that and went on to the board and served on the board. And at that time, it was an amazing board. And we can talk about, I'm not sure what highlight on this agenda, but there's some really things happening. But at that time, it was amazingly exciting. I was working, I think Harstie was on the board at the time. I was on the board. Jetta Goodman was on the board. Amazing people, right? And one of the things that was happening on the board at that time was the IRA was being criticized heavily for not being international. It was really US-based. And the only reason that ever, at least initially, included the international sort of title was because of the relationship with Canada. That's international, United States and Canada. So while I was on the board, there was a lot of pressure within IRA to expand its international engagement across both in terms of European countries and European reading associations, et cetera, that existed to expand that connection and build that, but also to begin to work in international development in developing countries. And the first step in that was to hire a director of international programs. And that was where I first met Scott Walter. And Scott Walter was the first, I'm still very good friends with him. In fact, I still work with him and work with the organization CODE in Canada on projects in Liberia and Sierra Leone. But at that time, Scott was brand new. He had was coming into ILA or IRA at that time, not having any idea. I mean, he's very engaging. So he can talk. But he really had no idea what it was that we were going to do. And the only thing that opened up, so we got together and he pulled together a group of ex-Peace Corps volunteers. So,
oh, nice.
So Jerry Harstie's ex-Peace Corps, Jane Hansen's ex-Peace Corps. There are a number of sort of
interesting. I didn't
people
know that.
In reading and literacy that went that Peace Corps route at some point. So Scott's idea was to get together these Peace Corps people, ex-Peace Corps people, and that we would plan an agenda for IRA.
Cool.
And it was. And the initial opportunity was to work with Peace Corps itself. That fell through, and nobody ever has explained to me what fell through. But in the meantime, we had three opportunities. One was to work in Belize, because Scott had done work in Belize. And so it was using a project that Nancy Roser and I had worked on language and literacy, which was using trade books in classrooms with text sets and read alouds and response and all of that. That was an opportunity to do that in Belize. The other opportunity was to work with Charlie Temple and Kurt Meredith and Jeannie Steele. We're doing a project in Czechoslovakia on what was called reading, writing, and critical thinking. And then the third project was a project in Africa. All three of those happened. The reading, writing, and critical thinking project, I was not a part of, but that was funded by the Soros Foundation. It was, and many, many, I mean, named people in reading. They were often part of that reading, writing, critical thinking, which was working in Eastern European countries in that breakdown of the Soviet Union and working with teacher educators in that system to try to bring more sort of democracy and prerogative and professionalism into classrooms that teachers were working in.
That must have been amazing. What an exciting time that must have been.
It was huge. Jerry did it. I mean, it was, they basically took just people. I mean, Tim Shanahan did it. I mean, there were just a lot of people that worked, and it was fairly short term. It was typically, I think it was doing workshops with this reading, writing for critical thinking initiative. They had some modules that they used. So it was very successful.
Wow.
And I was never involved with it because I was doing the Belize project, which also then transitioned into the Africa project, because Scott had done work in Africa. He had been a volunteer, I believe, in Swaziland. So he had some connections in South Africa. So I went with him to South Africa to meet with South African educators around possibilities of collaboration. And then we began to work with the Reed Educational Trust, who had just been given $50 million or something by gold miners. In basically, it was that, you know, the sort of social conscious side of the extraction, you know, businesses. And they wanted to set up a study that would work all over South Africa, in all provinces, in all languages. No, not all provinces, but in English. That was in the English project. And in that project, we worked with schools everywhere. And what they asked us to do was to build the assessment for that project. So the assessment tools, they had an intervention. Reed Educational Trust had a lot of connection with folks from Australia. I don't use the word language, but probably in that direction of what they were trying to do in classrooms with quality literature in schools. And when we did this, that's where my partnership with David Pearson happened, because he and I directed the evaluation. It was a 5-year evaluation study of that project. And so I was going to South Africa 5 times a year. Sometimes usually the trips were 2 weeks, sometimes they were longer. So it was a very intensive 5 years of work, but focused on primary grade reading instruction and the effects of working with teachers and teacher preparation, teacher education, in-service teacher education around that. And so then from that project, Misty and I became partners, and we saw an opportunity to work with USAID in a project that was bringing minority serving institutions to work in countries in Africa. And there was an opening for a partnership to work in South Africa. And since we already had a partner there, and Misty was at UT San Antonio, which is a minority serving institution, we were able to apply and were awarded another 4-year grant working in South Africa, but working in working in indigenous languages, the 9 indigenous languages, and developing books. So there was a lot of book development, authors sort of, and teachers as authors of those books. So we did a lot of workshops with teachers in which we created these books and ended up, 9 million books were distributed. That's the classrooms 4, 5, and 6, mainly focused on content area, indigenous languages, but working in the areas of science, mathematics, and social studies. It was a huge project. and then we did again another round of that project in Malawi, which was another 5 years. But we moved down into first grade and second grade, third grade, which was a lot more comfortable for us.
Yeah.
But again, to book development with teachers. And out of that came Mozambique, which was a 5-year project that we worked on. And that was more focused on working in pre-service teacher education. And that was sort of being home and excited about being the opportunity to work in teacher ed. And we were able to bring people to the States, take people there. That's been a great project. Oh. That's a long answer again.
No,
But all of that sort of international work, if you add it up, it's about 20 years.
That's so cool.
And in between, there were other projects working in Thailand, working in Cambodia, and again, it's rooted in this sort of desire to work internationally, to learn, to grow, to learn from the people there, to recognize the expertise. And the challenges that you're working with USAID, which tends to take a very, like lots of international aid, tends to take a very deficit approach, a very planner sort of stance towards we've got problems we need to fix, and we have that expertise. When that didn't reflect us and our perspective at all, we were much more local, valuing of local expertise, problem posing rather than problem solving, and all of the things that that we value in terms of our work certainly came into conflict with organizations, and particularly with USAID. You know, after 10 years of funding from USAID, they totally bit into EGRA, and I don't know if you, is EGRA a term that it's early grade reading assessment. Basically, it's DIBELS. In fact, it is exactly DIBELS exported from the States into all developing countries that are working on literacy. And even up to today, USAID, and not just USAID, the World Bank and the Gates Foundation, people that do international work in teacher education and literacy have totally swung to
EGRA.
And it is literally, I mean, you can go and see projects where it's simple view of reading. It's all about, rate. It's all about accuracy. It's all about reading words and nonsense words and lists just over and over again until they read them faster and faster. I mean, it is the worst possible thing.
Out of context, culturally.
And I have a piece somewhere, I think in RTE on EGRA and DIBELS. I mean, it's, why are we exporting the worst of what we've done with kids in classrooms into this international space? And yet it's still hugely, hugely dumb.
Does that surprise you? I mean, so in that work, was that a surprise? Or was there anything about the work, I should say instead, that surprised you? Like, were there...
Well, the surprise was for us was... it wasn't a surprise. The idea that we were going to be working, and this spans the projects in Mozambique, Malawi, and in South Africa, that we were going to be working with teachers to write books for kids that would be used in instruction. That was met with, that's not possible. And there was kind of several forms of pushback. One was from publishers, particularly in South Africa, where there is an active publishing community, that we were disrupting something that is their basal programs that they had. But the success that, so I wasn't, we weren't surprised, but the success of these teachers in writing these beautiful, beautiful stories, important stories based on their experience and taking them through that writing process and seeing the impact and seeing the quality of the books that came out of that and the use of the books in classrooms. I don't want to say it was a surprise, but it was certainly an affirmation that of the resources that are there that are not being tapped into. And still, even we, I don't know if we fell short, but one of the things we learned through that process was the, and this is something that I feel very strongly about today, that the teachers that participated in those workshops, and so it would end up to be about a year of book, a book would take a year or so to develop. They were done in cohorts and they were done in different languages. Of course, we were facilitating English, which was interesting, but that's another story. But what we learned was that those teachers were going back to their classrooms and re-engaging, reimagining what writing looked like in their own classrooms. And it wasn't part of the program, but they would come back in our workshops and talk about what they were doing in their classrooms with their kids in writing. That's a surprise. So that is a legitimate sort of like, wow, this is amazing, that seeing that sort of step for them of seeing themselves as writers.
Okay, the transfer.
And, yeah, and being successful as writers was something that they could take back and work with their kids.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it really was.
I'm curious now, just as a, do you have any of the books with you? I mean, do you have any, did you keep any?
Oh, God, we've got, so yes, we have. Nice.
Okay.
Misty, we've got them in boxes.
Okay.
So I mean, one of the sad things is, and this is typical of many projects, that those, I mean, there were all kinds of issues. We had classrooms and schools, with schools, rural schools, where that distribution of books would happen. They'd do the workshops. The books, we'd visit the schools and the books would be in the principal's head teacher's office.
Yeah.
Still in shrink wrap.
Oh.
Because they didn't want the books stolen. They didn't want to be held accountable for where it went. I mean, it was just a way. So we really faced challenges in terms of the pedagogy and the shift in pedagogy. So I forgot where I was going. Oh, do we still have the books? Yes. Yeah. And we've got. But what I would hope is that those books would be used and reproduced and so on.
I'm not sure. I love that.
That is still going on. I mean, the conditions are really, really hard. I mean, when we were working in Malawi, we had in 1 year a series of floods in the southern part. And all of the books in those schools, all the schools were destroyed and all the books in those schools were destroyed. So it's a challenging environment to be working in. But teachers are amazing. I mean, we would do read alouds, and that isn't a practice in most classrooms, particularly because there weren't the books and class sizes are enormous. So that was really kind of a challenge for them to engage in read alouds with kids. In the first couple of workshops, we struggled until we realized, okay, you know what this is like? This is like storytelling, right? So do any of you have stories you'd like to tell? And it was amazing. I mean, we would sit in these workshops and they could not wait to get in front of the group and tell
it.
Some random story. and we kept, and once we made that connection that a good read aloud is just a good storytelling, and you become that, they're not shy. And they have all this capacity to work, particularly in engaging an audience as storytelling is going on. It transferred beautifully into their read alouds. So once we sort of realized, oh, that's how we tap into their expertise, they were great. They're just amazing, amazing read alouds. Best I've ever seen. Best I've ever seen.
I mean, love it.
Stuff that we couldn't do. I mean, how do you do a read aloud with 100 kids? Yes.
Oh, yeah.
In 400 square feet of a classroom.
Yeah.
They could do it.
One of the things that I've been finding interesting about doing this project is some of the similarities that scholars have shared about being in international sites and in the U.S. Do you find similarities with just teaching and teaching in general, or teachers in general? Did you find yourself making any comparisons in terms of like, wow, teaching in the U.S. is a lot like this, or teachers abroad, there's a common element about teaching, you know, like a common phenomena in terms of like what teachers or teaching is about. Like, I find that to be something fascinating that I'm hearing sometimes.
Yeah. I we're cautious. We're always cautious about comparisons because the resources and the access to resources is just so different, and to to not talk about that in terms of the deficits is really something we work hard not to do. What I would say in kind of puzzling through your question, there's no question that the work that we've done in teacher ed here is very much, let me talk about the there's two things I want. Well, let me talk about the Mozambique project. We're working in teacher training colleges. And so in those teacher training colleges, there are 22 of them across Mozambique. Every one of them has an elementary primary school on the campus of the teacher training college. Beautiful, perfect, zero contact. There's no contact at all in the teacher education program with that little school that's sitting right there. They operate totally independently. And it's fascinating. It's like, and so what we brought was, you know, how can we, and the government was actually supporting this, how can we get those teacher training programs earlier on in their programs more engaged with the kids, not necessarily with the teachers in a traditional sense of a practicum experience in a classroom, but doing mentoring of the little kids, tutoring the little kids, one-on-one sort of relationships, small group relationships that they would have as teaching experiences. So that's something we brought directly from our work in the U.S. So we set up little mentoring programs where they would go and they'd, there's a great set of videos on this where the little group of 25 pre-service teachers would march over into the elementary school and pull their kids out and we'd go over and we'd do this work. It was amazing. And so if I compare, there's no difference. I would take any of those pre-service teachers right back in. They were off the scale in terms of how related to and work with kids. It was also interesting. It was mostly male. Well, not mostly. I would say 50-50.
Interesting.
And that was something we certainly, you know, I can 40 different. Years at UT Austin, I can probably count 6 to 8 males actually worked with. Here it was about half. So that was like, well, this is good. But that work was directly sort of influential and it worked exactly in their context. And the challenges were none of the teachers at the teacher training college had ever taught in an elementary school. It's a path that comes out of secondary programs. So typically educators in the teacher training colleges have worked in a secondary teaching setting. Not all of them, but quite a few of them at least secondary. None of them worked in primary. And so the idea of, and yet they're teaching all methodology courses that support their working with elementary kids. And they were terrified. I mean, they wouldn't say that, but trying to get them to come down into working with us with elementary kids, they had just hadn't had that experience. Yeah. I mean, wasn't they were a capable different. Of it. They did not have experience in themselves and were terrified about it. Anyway, the thing I wanted to point out is something that I would say is similar no matter where I go and work with teachers is there are always these exceptional teachers that are just knock your socks off. How did you do that? How do you do this? We had a particular teacher in Malawi who had to walk 5 miles, I think, to the school every morning and go back 5 miles, had 100 kids in her classroom, and did stuff with books and kids and language and literacy that I've never seen. I mean, it was just in awe. And we see that at home too. I mean, you go to a school, you find these teachers that are just doing amazing things in spite of everything that's going on around them, are able to center themselves in their classrooms and be amazing. So what I see is the potential for amazing teachers everywhere.
Yeah, it's wild. It's like the practice of teaching is a universal. Of course, the contexts are different and there's different constraints and affordances. But I find that interesting just listening to stories about teaching, how, wow, you know, teachers are really amazing. It's just the practice of teaching to me is just, for me, it's always been elevated. But, you know, not having visited any of these contexts. It just, I find it to be interesting to hear how just, you know, that idea that teachers are amazing and the profession is really amazing. So it's kind of has elevated it even higher for me than just to understand it.
An appreciation too for language flexibility. That's the other thing that in our context, it's not unusual in my context because I'm almost always working in low-income communities. Most of those communities are in Texas, and most of those kids are Latino kids, Hispanic Latino kids. And so the language diversity that I work with here was very helpful for any of the work that I've done across Africa, because language policy, language variation is huge. You know, where you're working with teachers who speak four and five languages and kids who speak three or four languages. And then you've got official language policy that's privileging English. Anyway, it's and that varies by country, not just by country, but by regions within countries in terms of the language resources that kids bring, and trying to help policymakers, particularly, and educational leaders understand that that language diversity is a resource. It's not a problem.
It's not the problem.
Something wrong. It's something very, very useful and very important.
Oh, I love that. I love that, Jim. This is a question. How about suggestions or insights right now? I mean, I talked to you a little bit about your piece on contesting science that science silences, amplifying equity agency in design research and literacy teacher preparation. That's like one of my, I have several of my favorite pieces of your work, but recently that coming back to that often, I'm just going to read a little bit of your abstract. The science of reading construct is being used to shape the future of literacy teacher preparation and silence the voices and work of literacy teacher education researchers to the detriment of quality science, quality teaching, and quality teacher preparation. So I love that, especially where we are in the U.S. right now. And I wondered if you have some thoughts or some insights.
I have lots of emotion. first of all, that was a co-authored piece with Misty and Michiko. Yeah. So it's
a beautiful
piece. And I think in many ways, in that piece, we're revoicing things we hear from so many of our colleagues. So I don't think there's probably an original thought in that piece, because so many of us are in that same space of trying to understand, trying to continue to do the work that we do in a context where the policies that are shaping classroom practices are so at odds with what we're trying to value and present. And, you know, we had a survey done in Texas last year, the spring, asking teachers, did they plan to come back to teaching next year?
Yeah, what happened? Yeah.
70% of the teachers said they were thinking about not coming back.
Oh, gosh.
And I think that's the conditions of teaching, both, I mean, whether it's from a basic level of just salary, whether it's the new opportunities that are being presented or just complete frustration with what they thought teaching was going to be compared to what they're being asked and demanded to do. I just read a report. It was by some senator. It's a commissioned report on why we aren't doing the science of reading and why we should be and how everything we've been doing is wrong. And if you looked at it, this is a senator, and this is a national sort of report that's been prepared to argue for more SOR.
Right.
And if you look at the references that are claiming this is the science of reading, there isn't a single reference to research, a single actual research, or a single reference to an actual research study. 50% of the studies are, 50% of the citations are to Ed Weakley or Emily Hansford, or somebody else who's just revoicing things like, you know, there aren't three queuing systems, that's been proven false. And then there's like, could we look into that just
a little bit more?
Show me exactly where this research is coming from. And it's pretty
outrageous.
I mean, seeing as I'm trying to retire, as Jerry tells me, it takes time. I'm working on the theoretical models, the next edition of theoretical models with Misty and Donna Elliman and some other folks. I'm still engaged and involved. I'm finishing up on some studies, but I do see myself more and more stepping away and more sort of feeling bad that I'm stepping away from a fight that needs to, that teachers particularly and families and kids, they need support and I feel like I'm sort of retreating when I should be in the opposite mode. But I'm not sure. I mean, I don't buy into this too will pass. I don't think it's pendulums. Particularly, I think this is neither of those. I mean, I don't think we can wait and let it pass, and I don't think it's a pendulum. I think it's going to run a course, but I'm not quite sure yet what that course is going to be. And in some ways, Margaret, I think there's plenty we can do with working with code with kids. I absolutely believe that. And I think in a way, I think we've lost some sight of that in our teacher preparation programs. Part of that is, I gave the example in Mozambique, where the teacher educators were never taught in primary grades. That's pretty true in our field. If you look through the folks and look at their background and where they come from, we have a lot of secondary folks and great people. I mean, amazing scholars. It's nothing, but when you go down to calculate and find out where are the primary grade teachers, and where are their voices in this larger scholarly community? I'm not sure it's always present or as alive as it should be. And maybe I can sort of like look at science at reading and say, well, we should be paying attention to code. That's absolutely no question about that. So that's not a question. It's a question of how and what are teacher educators who are preparing teachers doing specifically to address code in the teacher preparation programs. And I would not be surprised at all if it's, what's the National Teacher Quality
Group? Oh, and CTQ.
Yeah. I mean, that's not the answer. Looking at syllabus is not the answer for how much code instruction is actually going on.
Right.
But I do think, so part of me is like, we could be doing a lot more. It's just what we need to be doing doesn't have anything to do with what the science of reading people are telling us we need to do.
Right.
We need to be paying a lot more attention to writing. I beat this drum constantly that kids use code in writing and come to explore the code and understand the code and how the code works much more through their writing than they do through their reading. Yeah. And we've got to ask backwards. We're constantly reading first, writing next. When code, direct, explicit, systematic, sequential code instruction, I'd like to see some evidence that that actually works.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know of any. I know attention to code works, but I don't know that what the claims from that are, from the research that the claims are being made from, are actually on target. I heard one the other day, somebody was going on about this recent study that's showed that phonemic awareness and phonological awareness should be taught to kids in the presence of text, that we shouldn't, even though it's a, and I thought, we've known that for ever. And certainly Linnea Geary showed that specifically 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's not a new.
This is a new discovery.
That's not
new discovery. When we do this, we should probably have text. And somebody's eventually going to discover that if we do this, and this is not new, if we engage kids as writers early on and allow them to do their invented spellings or whatever we're allowed to use, that's where they're exploring code. And then they can take that knowledge and apply it in their reading easily. But we've got, and I don't hear that from anyone in science or reading. Because
I love, I love that. I just to build on what you're saying, you know, I find it outrageous that, you know, I was just visiting schools in Ohio and they can't teach running records.
No.
They can't teach in teacher preparation how to run records. And as a former first grade teacher, like, I'm like, I don't understand how you can't. Like, I don't understand how, I don't understand where there's harm in that at all. But I find that that's happening. I've heard that from people in Ohio and North Carolina. Like, there's different pockets where they can't even say running records. They can't even teach it.
Yeah, NCTQ has, you know, the, I don't know if your school, you're getting a,
I don't
know. So every school I've ever been at has failed. NCTQ. But what they've changed recently is there used to be a things that they're looking for. So they're searching for your syllabi for mentioning this and mentioning that. Now, as part of the criteria, they're searching for things that you're saying that you can't say. So you can't say running. You can't say, I mean, you can't say guided reading. You can't say, I mean, it's
how is that a dirty word? I don't get it. I don't know.
No, I don't know I don't know what I would do if I didn't have, running records or miscue analysis as a way of seeing into.
I really agree.
And building strategies with kids.
I don't get it. I don't
know what you use unless you just change the name of it, which if that's but I also balk at that because of the vilification that's
going
on. I mean
people, it's just
people who are who have careers of as amazing scholars are just I mean you see it. I mean Marie Clay. I mean that's like
I know throwing her name. I know. Like, I find that so disheartening, and I feel like I agree with you. I don't think this too shall pass. I feel like there's something about it that feels vicious that it's causing me to really think, we really all need to be smarter.
People come back to this is the destruction of public education. That's the goal. It's not really about literacy or about reading or teaching that. It's to dismantle public education. And I would have trouble sending my own kids to a public school now because of the regulation. So if that's the point, you know, make it so painful and so disingenuous for kids and so unchild-centered, I'd have to send my kids somewhere else too.
It's a real struggle, especially if you're public. I mean, we wrestle with that. I mean, a public school advocate and to see some of the things I feel that connection there. So I love talking with you, Jim. It's so wonderful to hear you talk. And I feel like one of the things that I love about the work that you do, the writing that you do, especially is you have such a powerful voice, this quest for the perfect method or the silver bullet, Jerry, and you wrote that piece. And, I often think about that so often. And so I love your writing and I love your thinking. And given your career striving to really to transform thinking, any current advice for us in the field or for all of us in general in this work? What's your thinking? Any current advice?
I mean, the thing,
or
it's not small, but I do think we need to pay more attention to writing. I mean, I think in the digital spaces that we're working particularly, and if you look at, what's that, The Rise of Writing, who did Limits of the Local, she did the piece on,
It'll come to you at midnight tonight.
But I think that the amount of how writing is changing people's lives today. Everybody's a writer. I mean, 15 years ago, it's hard to, I don't like to write. I don't write. Everybody writes. Everybody has something to say, and everybody writes. It's changed. You know, the relationship of writing and reading in literacy is really shifting. And I think if there's a suggestion, I just think we need to be really active in thinking about our preparation of teachers to teach reading. We need to be sure that there's no space between that and teaching them writing. Even the odd spaces that we created, we have a reading methods course and a writing methods course. That's probably not a good idea. I mean, I think because these language systems interact so much, that the more attention we can pay to both reading and writing, I think that'll help us sort of disrupt some of the simple views and the focus just on reading, as if that's happening independent of oral language development, of thinking, of everything. So I guess I would say that is something that is something we need to be more intentional about and focused on in our work. The other thing that I just am writing about a lot right now is design research. And I think I've found a home for what I do. It isn't, and maybe it's made me a little bit smarter about how I do research and how I think about what research is. And so I've really come to just go all in for thinking about design research and the potential for design research as a tool for us in our scholarship and in relating to practice. And I use I use a lot of the different people right now in thinking about it, but I think the idea what I like is this idea that we are really about improvement. We're really about, some people call it design research, some people call it improvement sciences. There's lots of different names that people are applying to that, but I think the more we can move away from traditional sort of psychological roots in thinking about our work and thinking more of what we do in terms of we're designers, we're about not understanding what is, but what could be. Or what should be.
Nice.
And so and the tools for doing that in design research are different from traditional sort of research, you know, the gold standard research that keeps getting thrown at us, to me, is not gold standard research. That's in psychology, yes, possibly. But if I look at COVID, the gold standard research, if that was the experimental studies that validated the effectiveness of it, that's not the real research that went on. Right. The real research went on in laboratories where people were trying to understand what was happening and how to make change,
yeah, right?
And how to make things better. That's what I think so the more we can move toward the design perspective on the work we do and not worry so much about generalizability or scalability, but rather think about, as I do about my work in teacher ed, what are the design principles that we have found to be important to pay attention to in the work we do in our particular context? And those design principles, if we can explicate those and represent those and ground those in data, then that gives other people, other researchers, opportunities to explore that in different contexts, to look at variations in those principles in different contexts and so on. So I am all in on design research, and I really see it as a movement that's taking hold. Sometimes I worry about formative design research, because that's sometimes when you say the term design research, people think formative design research.
Yeah.
All of Ryan King and that group.
Yeah.
And it's fine. I like formative design research, but it's still more, it's not what I think about design research. When I think of design research, I think of people making stuff and building new programs and studying and making iterations in those programs and looking at the influence of that in that iteration that they made and being more imaginative and being more creative in the work that they're doing, but not separated, not distant from actual empirical data. I mean, it's not non-data driven.
Right.
It's just data driven in a different way. So I think there's, I mean, particularly when you look at look at how we make progress in medicine, how we make progress in computer sciences. And I mean, it's not doing, you know, experimental studies where we push, you know, we introduce something and we do those kind of traditional contrast. We're actually building stuff. We're trying new things.
Right.
I think Jerry's career has been that, your career. I mean, I think people who understand that we're about making things better, that's the imperative for us as scholars. So I have this hope that will take hold. I don't know. I mean, it's very Kurt Lewin. It's very, I mean, all the kind of,
yeah.
It's very action practice based kind of work that we can do. And it's going to require a real transformation, but I see it. I see it in the learning sciences. I mean, we have faculty now who identify themselves as learning scientists, and improvement sciences, the Carnegie Foundation. I mean, a lot of people are doing improvement sciences, design sciences. I mean, those are all like groups of researchers that are approaching research from something that I think we as teacher educators or as classroom teachers can really benefit from and take up in our work. So that would be, did I say two things?
I love that. I just love that. Well, I thank you so much for talking today and all of the wonderful work you've done. And I'm a huge fan. And
yeah, we really haven't talked about specific programs at work, but that's all right.
I think your work just speaks volumes and just the sensibilities and the sensitivity you have in terms of approaching communities and the uniqueness that each community has and programs. And I find you so just your work so inspiring, you and your colleagues. It's such a model. And I feel like if policymakers and if the SRR people could just take some time to listen to some of these, you know, conversations, I feel like, boy, we could all get smarter by listening to individuals like you. So thank you.
That's right. Very, very nice. I'm honored to be asked and to participate. I really appreciate it. And I know your path quite a bit about your path. And that's for me an inspiring part of what we do in our careers is, I mean, I have had, I was trying to count the other day, the number of undergraduates that I taught in our program at UT Austin, who are now faculty at university,
part of
the research community. Mm-hmm. It's huge. I mean, it's huge. I mean, it's a lot of people who have come through our undergraduate program and somehow or another been inspired to continue that path into their own work. And what's been crucial in that always has been the doctoral students that I've worked with, because my undergraduates would never look at me and say, I want to do that. But they could look at the Rachel Salas, just go down the list of people. They could look at them and say, I want to do what you do. And what that was visible to them was that commitment and participation and mentoring that they did with those undergraduates that was part of our program. So I think that having spaces for doctoral students to grow into their own academic lives and in their own professional identities, the spaces for them to do that, to come through that kind of nurturing experience, I think is really important. And I don't know how universal that is. Yeah. I don't know that a lot of our doctoral students come into our professions through fairly traditional, kind of like what I did with Ron Carver. I was his TA. I mean, I wasn't his TA. I was his RA. And I was involved in every project that Ron was doing, either collecting data or analyzing data or doing stuff like that. I guess that prepared me for being an academic in some ways, but it wasn't nearly the kind of preparation that I think Jerry offered in his years and years and years of his work, or the kind of program that we've offered in Austin for our students to come through and develop their identities that are, you know, kind of this beautiful little path that they've come to understand. I'm working now in my last semester at UNT, and my partner is in the research. Was hired last year at UNT, and she was an undergraduate of mine, undergraduate student and a master's student of mine.
That's great.
They just hired another one who was a former undergraduate student at the university. So that's encouraging and inspiring that they're still willing to do this. I really, as I think about you and your relationship with Jerry and others, that's a path that I hope we can encourage people to continue to explore.
Well, you are exceptional, and thank you again.
Thank you.